divine up on. Meyer said that. So, okay, tell me when I can start. Okay. Okay, good evening, everyone. I'm very excited to begin this limud together. The limud of Ben Sarah Mara is a relatively neat limud. Welcome, David. I have a source sheet. So for tonight, we're gonna work mostly off the source sheet tonight. And depending on how far we get, we might start the Gemara next time or the time after that. But for this class, we're gonna do a little bit of a hakdama based on the psukim. And we're really gonna touch on three questions. The first question is on a pshat level, what are the qualifications for the ben soreh or moreh? The second question is about the context of the ben soreh or moreh in the Torah, the smichat ha-parshiyot, because it's in a section of Parsha Ki Tetzé, which is replete with other examples of rebellious, pernicious behavior. And then the third topic that we're going to try and cover tonight, really, again, from the pshat of the psukim itself, relates to what the nature of the chet was, of the Ben Sarah Mara. What specifically did he commit? So the topic of the Ben Sarah Mara is it's in the eighth parak of Masechet Sanhedrin, and it's a relatively neat limud in the sense that it has four psukim in the Torah. It's a perek in Shas, and I think there are six or maybe seven mishnayot in the perek. The first five of them deal explicitly with Ben Soreh Umoreh, and the other two deal with topic that are based on Ben Soreh Umoreh, Rodef, and other similar issues. But it's a relatively contained, neat unit, and so I'm excited to try and tackle it. I'm not sure if we're going to be able to do it justice in ten sessions, but we'll do what we can, and maybe if we like it, we'll continue beyond that. So when it comes to the psukim, let's read through the psukim in source number one. And we're going to take it pretty slowly so that we can really try and tease out the areas of ambiguity and the questions that Chazal will take up in the Midrashim and that the Rishonim will take up in their Perushim. So the Psukim read as follows, Kiyela Ish Ben, when it happens that a man has a son who is Sorer Umoreh. What does sorer mean? It comes from the verb of lasur, right? Which means to
turn aside.
To turn aside. Right, to deviate. Okay? And what is moreh?
Bit of a complaint.
Rebellious.
It's to rebel, yeah. So in English we give this this teenage boy the title of the rebellious child, right? So that really comes from the language of moreh. But the question is, are sorer and moreh synonyms or not? So the Midrashim try and say that no, there's no word in the Torah that's just there for a poetic flourish. It has ami significance. And so sorer refers to one sin and moreh to another. Sorer might refer to the rebellion against the mother, and moreh against the father. Maybe sorer, the Midrash says, could be against the Torah shebichtav, and the moreh is the Torah shebaalpeh. It tries to make sense of what these different descriptions are of what this kid is doing. So Einenu shomea b'kol avivu b'kol imo v'yisruoto v'lo yishma lehem. So what is the child or this Ben rebelling against? He's not listening to the voice of his father and the voice of his mother. It's interesting, who is the pasuk addressed to?
Man.
A father.
The father.
Right? So let's say a kid has no father. Right, he doesn't know who he was or was killed. Is it possible for the Ben Sira Moret to proceed for a child who is an orphan? The answer is no, right? There needs to be a father. And indeed, there actually needs to be a father and a mother who are on the same wavelength. And that is derived specifically from the parallel of the pasuk here, which says, "Bekol aviv ubekol imo." Why does it go out of its way to say "Bekol aviv ubekol imo"? We'll see eventually in the Gemara to demonstrate that the parents need to be on the same wavelength in terms of educating their child. They need to come from the same kind of pedigree. They need to come from a family of a fine background, because if the parents aren't on the same page and they don't come from a family of good, quality, then why can't the case of Ben Sira Moret proceed?
He's not deviating.
Yeah, he's not rebelling against his parents. Maybe he's continuing his parents, and therefore, who's to blame? Not him. Right? So all these qualifications are to make sure that the Ben here is the one who is at fault.
With regard to qualities, when we say that's like, for example, Reish Lakish or something, right? Certainly didn't have an illustrious start.
Yeah.
Right? But if his voice and the voice of his wife, that fits, but theoretically were of the same voice and of the right quality and of the right tone, would the kid get off because his father or mother had a tough upbringing?
On the charge of Ben Sira Moret, yes.
Really?
Yeah.
Even if their voices were united.
But you're saying that the father had a tough upbringing? Maybe he reformed himself.
I agree. That's what I'm saying. So I'm, in terms of, you reference sort of familial kind of quality and they need
to be at the same page when they're bringing him to the court.
So it doesn't matter what the father's pedigree was.
Well, in some ways it does. If the Mishnayot list a series of marriages in which, let's say, a Kohen marries a Halal or something like that, in which the marriage itself was problematic, and in such a case, that disqualifies the son from Ben Sira Moret. So there are certain qualifications that, even if they are on the same wavelength, the beginning of the marriage was the problem. But otherwise, they need to come with the same coal as they bring the child forward. So we'll see in the next pasuk where it says, Vitaf su bo aviv v'imo. They both grab him, v'hotziu oto el zigne iro ve'el shar makomo. That's where we'll see the Gemara derives that they need to be acting in unison. So if the father is the one who is doing it, who is saying, "Honey, it's time, we got to bring this guy to the juvenile court," and the wife refuses, so the Beit Din would not process the case. Okay? One comment about something in the pasuk Yudchet, Vayisroto. What does Vayisroto mean? They warned him, right? The parents made some effort to rebuke or reprimand or their son, and it didn't work.
It's the same root as a sorer, no?
Yep. So it's to try and admonish in order to get back onto the right path. So continuing in pasuk chaf, ve'amru el ziknei ro b'neinu zes sorer umore. So we have a repetition of the two qualifications of sorer umore again, as the parents are repeating the history of their son's behavior to the court. Einenu shomei bekoleinu, he hasn't listened to our voice. That's another repetition of from pasuk Yudchet. Now he says zolel v'soveya. So what does zolel v'soveya mean? It's a hard question to answer, but Rashi points us in the direction, if you turn over the Daf Mekorot, the last source here from Mishle says, Shmata b'ni v'chacham v'asher b'derech libech. So listen, my son, to become wise, you shall and happy, you shall walk down the path of your heart. Al tehi bisov e yain, you shall not be among those who indulge in wine. Bizolale basar lamo, or those who drink, or those who gorge, excuse me, in meat. Ki sovea vizolel yivaresho kraim talbish numat. So those who drink too much wine or gorge in meat, they become poor and etc. So from this pasuk in Mishle, we see these terms being used in a context in that indicates that what does zolel mean? Refers to what kind of misbehavior? A glutton. Yep. And a soveya is a drunkard. Okay. So that's the classic definition of these words and these behaviors. But it's interesting that these words seem to be tacked on to the report that the parents give the dayanim, but not something that was initially noted when the parents were observing what their child was doing wrong. Okay? So continuing in Pasuk Chaf Aleph, Urgamuhu kol anshei iro ba'avanim vameit. And so who would stone him?
Kol anshei iro.
Okay, so this the people of whose city? Who's Iro referring to?
Presumably the kid.
The family or the kid, right? So it's sort of a local, the punishment is meted out by
a
community, right? By the community that essentially failed to raise this child. They are the ones that are implicated, and they need to sort of redeem their complacency by participating in the punishment.
How does that redeem them? I mean, it's kind of a punishment itself, I think, that they're required to do that. But
yeah, so I think the end of the pasuk is where I was getting using that word from. It says, "Ubiar tamer kebecha v'kol Yisrael yishmu v'yirau." They've expunged that evil from their midst, and it's done in a very public way, so that everyone sees and hears. And so the public nature of it is sort of a way of saying, like, you know what, we're coming to grapple, or we're coming to the realization that we failed here, right? And so it at least makes them a little bit more alert going forward. Okay, so these are the psukim. And just to summarize, we have several qualifications for what it takes to become a ben sorer or morer. What are some of those qualifications? Just to sort of list them off.
Yes,
have parents. Okay.
Probably to violate both zolel and soveh.
So he has to violate both zolel and soveh. What else?
Parents have to be on the same page.
Okay.
He has to violate both of them?
Well,
Zolel and Sove?
We're not sure, but maybe. The Gemara will say yes, both of them need to be violated. But from the Pshat, it lists both. So presumably both are part of the reason for his punishment.
Well, parents need to believe in the issue enough to drag their kid there in unison and testify.
Yeah, so they need to be willing to pass this off to the courts without they can't deal with it in house, right? They both come to that place.
So before that, they had to try to deal with it.
Yeah, so they had to make an effort, right? They couldn't just pass the kid off to the public sort of juvenile system without doing something to take responsibility as parents first.
Do the parents need to know what the penalty could be? Can they be alerted?
I don't know. I don't know if they need to know what the potential punishment would be.
Presumably, if they're bringing them there already, they would know what they're in for.
Maybe not. They might not think that death would be the or the stoning would be the eventual penalty. But
there, I mean, this specifically says that you stoned the kid, but because, I mean, I've learned a little bit about this before, not that much, but he's stolen money, he's done other things, so is it a case where if they don't find, you know, I mean, they said that they never actually did this, but would there be enough, I mean, would it be possible in certain, along the way, if they can't convict him of the entire thing, to try him for stealing? Or, I mean, it's not just like an all or nothing proposition, right?
Well, it seems in this, at least this specific case, they're bringing him for the whole package, right? That they're saying he was Zolel v'Sovea, he was Sorer Umare. We have to define what those are. And that's going to be a big part of the third a part of our shir, is understanding what the nature of that sin is. Because one path that Chazal take is to say he committed horrific crimes like theft or even murder, or almost murder, such that he was deserving of the punishment. But that's a big stretch, and we'll go down that path soon. Okay, any other qualities that this young man needs to have? So one is that he needs to be a man. Right, the Meiri points out on the Mishnayot that this does not apply to a girl. Right, there's no bat sorer umore, and he gives the reason that the Torah is not as concerned for the lusts and desires getting out of control for a girl as it is for a boy. Okay, so
is there anything here about age?
Not yet, but the term leish ben is what the first Mishnah in the Perek spends a long time defining, what the window in which this case is relevant for. And we'll see that from this term, Le'ish Ben, the Mishnah and the Gemara teases out that it's between the age of 13 and like 13 and 3 months. It's a very narrow window. And it could be that depending on how a boy matures and how the signs of puberty manifest, it could be that if some boys turn 13 before the signs of puberty manifest, then there's never that window for Ben Sarah Moret. But we'll get there probably in the third or fourth shir when we look at that Gemara. Okay. So I think this is a good start for just trying to understand the psukim and having a handle over them so that we can refer back to them as we go forward. So the second issue that I wanted to cover in the shir tonight is the smichat ha-parshiyot, the context in which the Torah teaches us the sugya of Ben Sarat Umareh. So as I mentioned, this is from Parshat Ki Teitse in Perek Chaf Aleph of Sefer Devarim. Now, Parshat Ki Teitse begins actually in the middle of Perek Chaf Aleph on Pasuk Yud. But at the beginning of that Perek of Chaf Aleph, which is at the end of Shoftim, there is the mitzvah of Egla Arufa. Okay, if a person finds a dead body and there's no one who has there are no leads, then the city that's closest takes some responsibility for it by saying it wasn't their fault. But by saying it wasn't their fault, they also imply that they could have done more to prevent it. So that's the first topic in Perek Chaf Aleph. The second is Ki Tetzei L'Milchama Le'Evecha U'Netano Hashem Lokecha Be'Yedecha V'Shivita Shivyo Reita B'Shivyo Eisha Yifa Toar. So the second is the woman who one sees in battle, who one lusts after and takes into their home and has to let her sit for a certain amount of time and let her hair and nails grow. That's the second topic in the Perek. The third topic is Ki Tiyena Le'ish Shtei Nashim Ha'achat Ova V'achat Tznua, when a man has two women, when this was still allowed, and one is loved and the other is hated, and the son of the hated is the Bechor, the firstborn. The firstborn can't be denied his right of Pishnaim, of getting his rightful portion. And then the third topic of the perek is Ben Sorer Umoreh, our topic. And then the fourth and final topic in this perek is Halanat HaMet, the prohibition on leaving a corpse overnight without burying it. Okay? So it's this context is significant in understanding Ben Sorer Umoreh. So let's look at three sources which help unpack the smichata parshiot, the juxtaposition of parshas, of topics that I just detailed. So in source number two, this is the Sifrei, says Aviv Shel Zeh Chashak Yafat Tawar. So who is the Aviv Shel Zeh? This is on Pasuk Yud Chet. So this is talking about who? It's talking about the father of the Ben Sorer Umoreh. Okay? So who was this guy? What was his background?
He's a soldier.
A soldier, a military man.
He married Aisha Yafat Tawar.
Who married Aisha Yafat Tawar, right? Vihichnis Satan Latoch Beito. And what did he do?
Caused the Satan to enter his home.
He brought in some kind of evil spirit into his home. V'naase b'no sorer umoreh. And his son became a ben sorer umoreh. Now, does this indicate that the product of the father and the Eshi Yafat Tawar was the Ben Sorer Umoreh? Not necessarily, right? I think you could read this text and make an argument to say that there was another son who was already in the house, but then when the father lusted after this woman and brought her in after wartime, it caused a lot of commotion and unrest in the house, and that eventually precipitated into a pre-existing child becoming a Ben Sorer Umoreh. Okay? V'sofo, lahamito mita mishuneh. And in the end, what happens to this guy?
Sounds like he's going to kill or cause to die, right? Him, I guess, the Ben Sorer Umoreh in a unusual death manner.
The one he hates.
So I'm not sure about this last phrase. I think the way that you're reading it, David, is a possible read, which is to say that the father himself is going to murder someone in a way in which there's going to be a corpse, and we need to figure out how to deal with that corpse, right? Which is relevant to the final, the fourth topic in the perek of Halanat HaMet, of the prohibition of leaving a corpse overnight without being buried. Specifically, we're talking about when someone is hung. But another potential way to read it is V'sofo Lahamito, and in the end, this guy will be brought to his death, right? That this father will be killed in a grotesque fashion, and the parsha of Halanat HaMet will become relevant to him. Okay? So it's possible that all the four parshiot of this perek are relevant to a single character. Okay? So the Sifrei is trying to connect the dots and say that the Ben Sorer Umoreh isn't happening in a vacuum, okay? It's the product of other activities, of other things that are preceding it, and it also leads to other things, okay? So the it doesn't necessarily connect to the Egla Arufa, right? Which is at the end of Parshat Shoftim, but at least it connects the four issues of Eshat Yafat Tawar, Ben Hasnua, Ben Sorer Umoreh, and Halanat HaMet. Yeah.
My wife has mentioned to me that somewhere she picked up the idea of conservation of characters, I guess, in the Chumash, meaning Shifra and Pua, who are they? Oh, those are the same two people as these other two people. So I'm thinking over here, in other words, we have these cases, but really it's just one person.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I think there is that tendency to try and collapse characters or see several parshiot that on the surface have no connection to each other to actually be very connected to each other, right? Smichat ha-parshiot is something that Rashi does on a regular basis, and it was a pastime of many of the parshanim. They enjoyed seeing the significant order of the Torah, and that it wasn't just spliced and diced for any with no reason. It was done in a divine intentional way. So this effort, I think, is part of that larger trend of seeing the interconnectedness of the Torah and the chronology within a given parsha as being significant, or the order within a given perek being significant. Okay. So let's look at two other midrashim here, which discuss this issue of smichat ha-parshiot in adding a little bit of another layer to it. So in Devarim Rabbah, Ben Azai Omer quotes the Mishnah from Pirkei Avot. Ben Azai Omer, mitzvah goreret mitzvah, right? So a good deed causes a good deed. The avera goreret avera. So what is Ben Azai saying? That there is causality, right? Good things lead to other good things, and bad things lead to other bad things, right? So there is, we could call it moral inertia, right? That if something begins in a bad direction, it's likely to continue in that direction. And if something begins in a good direction, it's likely to continue in a good direction. So Ketzad, so what's the example for demonstrating Ben Azai's principle, which is something that we are familiar with and teach to our kids? So what's the proof for this in the Torah? So Ketiv, Lamala, ki teitze lemilchama v'ra'ita b'shivya, amar Kadosh Baruch Hu, afal pi shehitarti ota lecha, amarti lecha, v'galchat rosha, v'asta tziporneha, kedei shelo timzachen v'enecha, v'tishlach ota. Right? I gave you all these warnings and told you that if this happens to you and you're in this compromised situation, I told you that you shouldn't take her, and if you do, you should do it in this way, and this is all so that eventually you will not want her, so that you will send her away. V'im lo asita kein, but if you didn't follow my lead, ma kativ acharav, then what's going to happen? Then you are going to have a rebellious child. And then eventually you'll have this situation of a person doing a sin which requires a death penalty, and then you'll have to bury the corpse in a respectful way. So what does this string of topics prove? Avera goret avera. Okay, so this is the proof. These smichat parshiot are used as the proof for this concept.
But it seems unfair. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah.
I thought the way that these different topics work is it gives you a way to follow them. Right. If you go into war and you find a woman, you should do this. Let her hair grow. Let her nails grow. So on and so forth.
Yeah.
That's not an avera, is it?
You go through the trouble to do it the right way.
If you're doing it the right way, yeah. Maybe it's not the best way, but it's
Isn't the right way supposed to then cause the man's heart such that he releases her at the end? Wouldn't that not be the right way?
So that is the implication of the directive, is that you're supposed to get the message that Hashem really doesn't want you to do this, right? But if you're gonna do this, this is the best way to do it. But even doing it that way is not a good way, right? So by making her really ugly, you're supposed to get the message that this isn't the right thing to do. Okay, so is it an avera to do? So Rashi quotes that this is talking to a person's lusts, talking to their yetzer hara. The Torah is talking to a person's yetzer hara. So you can argue both directions. You can say this is allowed by the Torah, right? The Torah says if you're in war and this happens to you, this is the way to handle it, right? Or you can say, as this midrash is arguing, which is to say that you shouldn't be doing that, right? Get like the undercurrent is that it's a severely compromised path to go down, and you shouldn't be doing it.
But the Torah is not shy about calling things usser. Why in this particular instance set up a whole mitzvah and then say, well, if you do this mitzvah, it's still...
Well, yeah, Vera. It's a good question. Why is it that the Torah here is Dibra HaTorah, I forget the exact language, Yetzer Hara. Why is it that it engages the desires of the Yetzer Hara and allows for them to proceed? It could have just said, don't take this woman, right? So why does it allow you to start going down the slippery path, especially if it's going to lead to horrible things? It's a good question. It would take us a little bit off into the sugya of Eshi Yifat Toar, which is a fascinating topic in its own right. But the point that I wanted to emphasize here is that once you start going down that path, it snowballs. All right? One bad thing leads to another bad thing, which leads to another bad thing. There's a chain of causality here, which Ben Azai is proving through the Smichata Parshiot of Ben Sorer Amore.
I must say, I think it's really narrow to consider that the directives of the Torah, all as mitzvot, aseh or lo aseh, and in a sort of, clearly, the Torah doesn't have sort of rules and there are sort of norms and cultural things to do, perhaps, that don't fit neatly into this is an essay and this is a love, you know? We reflect on the character of the avot and their behavior, you know? That's certainly a teaching of the Torah. So, you can have the Torah say, this is how you deal with the situation. If you're in the situation, this is how you deal with it, you know? And hopefully, yeah, I think there's an undercurrent that ideally you will release the woman, you know? This also gets to me, this whole thing about mitzvah shlokhan, when you get rid of the mother bird.
Yeah.
Do we like have a special kavanah that you would go around and find all these mother birds so we can do the mitzvah and get rid of them all and then take the egg? Or is it a concession to the situation that somebody's in, they need the egg?
Right.
You know, what's the difference in a sense?
And that's what Chazal say on the first two words, the first three words of our parsha, ki yel ish ben. Right? When it happens that you find yourself in the unfortunate circumstance where your child is this rebellious, this is how to deal with it. Is the mitzvah of Ben Sura Mareh a mitzvah kiyumit or mitzvah chiyuvit, right? No, it's a mitzvah kiyumit.
The parents are rejoicing, yay, we got the mitzvah to bring our kids to the stoning.
Right.
No.
Of course not. Heaven forbid. So it's not a mitzvah chiyuvit that one is obliged to put themselves in a situation where they can fulfill the dictates of Ben Sura Amareh. It's a mitzvah kiyumit that if you're in the situation where you find yourself to have these factors in front of you, then this is how to handle it. Right, it's not necessarily endorsing the circumstance. It's saying we live in a world where these things could happen, and if that does happen, this is how to handle it. The parsha of Eshi Yifat Toar, similar to Ben Sarim, is dealing with a b'dieved reality, where things are already compromised, things are already non-ideal, and this is sort of the best way forward. Okay. In source number 4, there's actually an example of a ben sorer umorer in Tanakh. And if we go down 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines, the first word in the line is umorer. So the underlined part here of Kolman Denasiv Yifat Toar Nafik Minaihu Bain Sora Umore. So here the Midrash is saying that anyone who marries a Ben Sora More, the product from them, from that union between the Ish and the Esha Yifat Toar, will be the Ben Sora More. So there, that's unambiguous in terms of what leads to what. It's not that the household will be thrown off and another child could be compromised, but it's saying that the product of a lustful pursuit of a woman in war will likely lead to Shekein Matsinu B'David, because this is what we have seen in the case of David HaMelech. Al Shechamad Macha Bat Talmi Melech Gashur B'tzeitol Milchama. Right, David lusted after the daughter of Talmi, and what was the product of the union with Macha? Yatza mimenu Avshalom, shebikesh laharogoto, who tried to kill his dad. Veshachav imnashav leinei kol Yisrael leinei Hashemesh, veyadon hargu kama revot Yisrael, vasam machloket b'Yisrael, etc., etc. Right, Avshalom wreaked havoc for David on many different levels, and so the Midrash here is giving us an example of the connection between an Esha Yifat Toar and a Ben Sora Umoreh in the example of David.
In this case, are they using the term Ben Sora Umoreh as a sort of just as a category of a problem kid? Because I thought that we said earlier, to meet the Torah definition, the parents had to be not to blame.
Great point. Right, so it must be that Ben Sora Umoreh is taking on a more sort of metaphorical kind of definition here. All right, it's a metaphor for a kid who does bad things, right? But it's not used literally, because, as you said, does Avshalom meet any of the qualifications of these psukim? Maybe one or two, right? But certainly, on the surface, he's not a classic Ben Sora Umoreh. But nevertheless, he's called one. Okay, and so we'll see that there is a tension about whether Ben Sora Umoreh is a theoretical category or an actual category. Rabbi Shimon makes the case that lo haya velo atid lihiyot, that a Ben Sora Umoreh never was and never will be. And why was it written? Lomar drosh makabel schar, that the whole reason for Ben Sora Umoreh is for us to sit here in the Beit Midrash and to learn it, right? And to get some schar as a result. But not because the Beit Din or the Sanhedrin ever used these laws to adjudicate a case of a rebellious minor.
Why not say it's there to put the fear of God in
okay, good.
And,
so,
in a wayward child, or something.
Yeah. So we're
happens to be a good learner, of course. So they would
he would know what to do wrong. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You've got to get the exact things wrong to meet the to be a Ben Sora. You have to be a Talmud Chacham to be a Ben Sora Moreh.
Right.
Yeah. Indeed. Right. That's the Russia. So we'll see that. But the Ramban that we're about to see makes that point, Andy, which is that the last pasuk, which we read in the section of Biratar Mikabech of Kol Yisrael Yishma V'Yirao, that what's the point of Ben Sora Umoreh? To instill fear in every raging Jewish 12-year-old boy. That, you know, just watch out, because you might become a Ben Sora Umoreh.
Super duper slurpy.
Yeah. So there is an educational value to this parshia, even if it's not a judicial or a legal one. Okay, so we'll see that the Ramban.
It's a law in the books versus a law. What do you say? That's actually in practice or something.
Yeah, yeah. I think there's a fancier term, but that.
I'm
but,
sure there's a fancier.
But then that gets to the question. So what's the purpose of a law in the books? Does it really act as a deterrent, or not? So we'll talk about this in greater detail. But for now, we're sort of just raising that question. Okay. So I think,
according to you said Rabbi Shimon, lo haya velo
atid lehiot.
Yeah, so that's not a deterrent. If you know there never was one and there will never be one, then it's just to get schar. Then it's not a deterrent at all. I mean, as soon as you tell a 12-year-old, like, oh yeah, don't worry, because it's
he shouldn't read that
virtually impossible for this to happen.
If he reads about forest, we're in trouble. Yes.
Yeah. Right. Well, there's someone who disagrees. There's in the Yerushalmi. Rabbi Yonatan says that there was a Ben Sura Mara and I sat on his grave. Mm-hmm. Right? So what does that mean? Some people say that refers to Avshalom, right? Which gets back to the point that you made, Michael, about maybe Rabbi Yonatan is just understanding this whole thing to be a loose sort of category of children who rebel, right? And then it might play a deterrent kind of role because the category is invoked even for people who don't necessarily meet all the qualifications.
Well, couldn't you say still learn something up? Couldn't you say that in terms of having a limud out of it, in terms of the actions that you might take as a father regarding going to war and conquering a whatever woman, what have you, versus and even if the son isn't a legalistically a ben sura mara, that there's still learning that can happen from historical. You can still have a wayward child that even doesn't meet the legal definition. You can still have a lot of pain and suffering in your life and his life, even if, again, the legal definition isn't met, and therefore the legal execution of judgment and din isn't executed. I mean, right. It can still be.
There's a spectrum of misbehavior.
Yeah, right. You know,
he can still be over on kibud av ve'em, right? In a way that's punishable without necessarily going to the extreme of being a ben sura mara. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, well, just in terms of, I don't think necessarily reading, you know, the deal with David and Avshalom.
Yeah.
More loosely, and as a definition of insert, it goes against necessarily a stricter read above and in the source. You know, I mean, it's still,
yeah.
It just means perhaps you couldn't execute judgment on Avshalom according to that legal standard, but it doesn't mean bad things didn't fall out in a similar manner to everyone based on that prototype.
Right.
You know.
Right, it depends on how we understand the word Chikain Matsinu B'David, right? Does that mean that this category it should be taken, you know, literally for Avshalom, or no, it's a similar kind of case.
It's similar enough to what happened, that bad things happened to David.
Yeah. Okay. So I think for now we're going to skip the rest of this Midrash Tanchuma, but we're definitely going to come back to it because there's a really important question that Rabbi Yossi raises here about does the crime meet the punishment, and we'll certainly get back to that. But let's for now go to the Ramban and the Rashi, and I want to try and develop a little bit of a hakira, a distinction of two ways to look at what the nature of the sin was based on the psukim and the smichata parshiot that we have discussed thus far. So let's look at the Ramban in source number 5. So we can skip the first sentence and pick up at vihine on the second line halfway through. Vihine yesh alav shnei onshin. The ben sura mara has two punishments. Ha'achad shehu mekale aviv ve'imo u mamre bahem. So what's the first charge? What's the first wrongdoing or first crime of the ben sura mara?
Cussed him out.
Yeah. That he... Mikalel is different than Mikale. Okay. I think Mikale is
did you hit him?
More of a I'm sorry?
Littles.
I thought it was more Make would be with a chaf. But I'm not sure. I think I thought it was more to disrespect, to make small or light. That's how I understood this word. And umamre bahemen, he also rebels against them. So he is disrespectful to his parents and rebels against them. So that's the first crime that he commits. V'hasheni, shehu zolel v'soveya. So the second is that he's zolel v'soveya. So the Ramban here sees these as two different types of crimes, both of which the Ben Sarer is guilty for committing. But the nature of the sin is dual. It's twofold. The first relates to the parents and is a function of sorer umore, or we could say inenu shomea bekol aviv ubekol imo. And the second one is shehu zolel v'sovei. And here is the critical chidush of the Ramban. Over almashen nitzdavenu kedoshim tihiyu. And so what is the iser that the Ben Sarer Umare was over? It was on the mandate of kedoshim tihiyu. V'nemar od, and it says, furthermore, ve'oto ta'avdu ubotid bekun, that you need to serve God and cling to Him. Kasher perashti shenitztavenu ladat Hashem b'chol d'racheinu. We have to know, we're commanded to know God in all of our ways. V'solel v'soveya lo yeda derech Hashem. This young man will never know the ways of God. So this is a fascinating chidush of the Ramban, which is to say that an element of the Ben Sarer Umare is the rebellion against the parents, but there's another dimension here, which is a violation of Kedoshim Tiyu. And that's a function of the Zolel V'Soveya. And what does the Ramban say in Kedoshim Tiyu? How does he define what that means?
That you should cleave to God and serve Him.
Correct. And he says there that Al Tiyu Naval B'Reshut HaTorah. Right? That you shouldn't be sort of a trickster such that you technically keep the law, but violate the spirit of the Torah. And he gives the examples specifically of a guy who eats a ton of glut meat and is a glutton, right? Or someone that becomes drunk over mevushal wine, right? So have you broken the Torah?
No, you can be a nivul v'reshut satara.
No and yes, right? Yeah. Technically you have not, but the Ramban says that is the violation of Kedoshim Tiyu. For the guy who thinks he can weasel through by, you know, stocking up on a million kosher hot dogs, that's still a violation of being Kadosh. Okay? And so the Zolel v'Soveya corresponds to the examples that the Ramban gives in Kedoshim Tiyu, because the Zolel v'Soveya is there anything wrong with a kid having meat and drinking wine?
Well, it's in proportion. And if
okay, so
to their parents, but if they're rebelling, it's part of their rebellion, and it becomes, you know, the attic could be a real problem. I mean, on its own, I guess it's interesting. On its own, I'm going to take you guys a far from this, but like, so there's not a din regarding the man, right? Or the person that's if it's the child that has a parental relationship that he's breaking, right? Because I guess presumably even if he's Sylvain and Zalel, but he's got parents he's listening to that can they can pull him out of this rut, perhaps, as a path forward to Derech Hashem, right? But if he's in this state, this gluttonous mm-hmm. state, this drunkard state, and he doesn't even respect his parents,
then it's a recipe for disaster.
Then what's going? There's no path forward. There's no path forward to Derech Hashem, right?
Right. So that's why the dual nature they reinforce each other.
Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a hopelessness here because both of those factors are in play. So the Ramban makes the point that there is a dual nature to the sin of the Ben Sera Umareh. The al haklal, ein bo atachet mavet. And in general, this young man has not committed a sin deserving of death. The al shem sofo hunidon, and he's judged based on what he will eventually do. Kamoshi yizkarnu rabotenu, as the Mishnah in Sanhedrin, which we'll see next time, says explicitly. V'zehatam kol Yisrael yishmu v'yirau. And this is the reason why the Parshia of Ben Sera Umareh concludes with that the entire Jewish people will hear about this and they will see it. Ki lo humat begodel chato. So it's not about this young man deserving the extent of his or dying because of the extent of his sin, ela liaser bo atarabim v'shelo yeh takala le'acherim. So what is the purpose of Ben Sera Umareh? To make an example.
It's pretty tough. Yeah.
It's tough, but it's the way that a society works. Well, that if you make an example of one kid,
right,
other kids,
right,
learn.
Well, we have the example of the wayward city, right?
Yeah.
That's gone over to Avodah Zarah.
Right. Right.
I mean, I guess it's an example. It's certainly, I guess they've earned their punishment, presumably, through Avodah Zarah, but there's also a demonstration aspect to it.
Yeah, the Irani Dacha, it becomes a deterrent for other cities.
Well, it's interesting that that's another example of Lo Haya V'lo Nivre.
Yep, that's another link. And now the Ramban lists other kinds of cases in the Torah which are meant to serve as deterrents within society. So V'chein Derech HaKatuv She'yazhir Ken Kasher Yamutu Legeder. So whenever there is the Torah is warns about something which is approaching the border, Kedeshi Tev Mitatan Takana La'achirim, and is willing to kill an individual so that it can fix society. Kihizker Ken Bezaken Mamre. A famous case is the Chacham in the Sanhedrin who is outruled, or he's in the minority of the opinion, and he rules according to the minority, right? He doesn't follow the majority, and he publicly does so. In saying that, in providing a minority psak, has he done anything worthy of death? No. But if someone who is in the minority opinion starts his own camp of people who follow a different law, then that's the end of civil society, right? It's the end of the justice system. If majority wins doesn't actually work or isn't followed, and so that's why the Zaken Mamre, who's a Talmud Chacham, needs to be put to death, because the potential threat is immense.
If he does what exactly?
All he needs to do to be deserving of being put to death is publicly declaring that people are allowed to follow the minority psak of the Sanhedrin. Okay? So he hasn't actually followed it, or he hasn't, all he's done is given the psak, and he's already deserving of death.
But it's not, he was entitled to have a minority opinion while they deliberate.
Correct, but once the psak comes through, he can't go against that. And similar with the person who sways people to do Avodah Zarah, Even though he hasn't committed any idolatry, but he's told people to follow it. Okay, so I skipped the Edim Zomim, but that's another situation where the witnesses haven't actually put anyone to death yet. And Edom Zomim, who actually do cause someone to put to death, aren't killed. It's only those who are caught to be lying in the attempt to put someone to death are actually killed themselves. It's so to enable there to be credible witnesses in the court system. So these three examples, the Ramban groups together with Ben Sirat Moret to say that there is not absolute justice on a narrow level for this individual. But sometimes, for the sake of society, an individual needs to suffer greatly in order to keep certain systems in check. So that's where Ben Sirat Moret is. And now we'll just conclude with this final sentence, and this will sort of wrap things together. V'gamzu mitzvah mechudeshet. And so this aspect of Ben Sirat Moret is a mitzvah mechudeshet. It's something which is new. Is it a mitzvah mivu eret, something which is an expansion or an explanation of min kabed et avicha v'yatimecha, v'ish imo v'aviv tira'o. So here the Ramban, in his concluding sentence, is offering a critical chakira, a critical distinction in how to understand Ben Sirat Moret. Either it's a law which is a chidush, in that it is connected to Kedoshim Tihiyu, right? And it's its own element of, which we could say is connected to the Bi'arti Hara Mikir Becha in the Pasuk, in the concluding Pasuk. Or it's a function of Kabeir Et Avicha V'Yatimecha and Enenu Shomei B'Kol Aviv V'Kol Imo. And the distinction between those two is important. Because if it's a mitzvah mechudeshet that's related to making an example of in society, then we're willing to say that this individual is getting a punishment that doesn't meet the crime. But for the sake of society, for the sake of Kedoshim Tiyu, he needs to be made an example of. But if it's a function of kibud av va'eim, then the question of justice is an important one. Right, and we need to be able to justify that his sins make him deserving of death. And so if we go down that path, that this is a mitzvah mivu eret, then we're going to need to ask the question that Rabbi Yossi and others ask about nidon al shem sofo. That really, this guy is being judged based on something that he will inevitably do. Right, we need to at least broach that question of justice if we're talking about this as a function of kibud av va'eim. And if it's a mitzvah mechudeshet, then we're emphasizing the zolel v'soveya piece, right? That this guy's character is a character that's harmful to society. Whereas if it's a mitzvah mivu'eret, a function of kibud av va'eim, then it's really a more local, domestic kind of thing, that this kid is causing havoc in his home, right? It's eino shmeba kol aviv kol imo. But that's very different than being a menace to society. And so I think what the Ramban is pointing out here is that there is a dual nature to this that emerges from the psukim themselves. And we'll see that he says it at first that it's really shnei onshin, right? That there are two dimensions here. And it's not an either or, but it's really a both and. But we'll see how different Rishonim emphasize one over the other. We've got to go for Marv. So we'll conclude here. And this was very enjoyable for me. So, Shakoach for the learning.